try to deal with a skunk, you may get, the smell may, So you don't want to touch the skunk directly. You know what skunks are? There are no skunks in New Zealand, are there? Did you know there are no snakes in this in New Zealand? Yes. That means there's no envious people. So, how to deal with the skunk in a tasteful, tactful way. You'll hear some graphic descriptions from the Shastra, but I'll just let Bhagavatam and Bhagavad Gita talk, and I will not venture forth in that way. I'll be telling some stories. That always makes things easier to digest. We'll be talking about trickling honey. We'll be speaking about water in the desert. We'll talk about forest fires, mosquito bites, and chewing that which has already been chewed. So in this way, those who want to catch the meaning will certainly have ample opportunity to do so, and those who are determined to avoid these realities, they'll also have some escape route. Oh, they're just stories, just allegories. The title of today's discussion, Got to Feel It. That's the sum and substance of culture these days. There's some mental and intellectual stimulation, but the bottom line is got to feel it. So the intelligent person asks the question, feel what? What exactly are you interacting with? Whether you look at the situation from the perspective of understanding you're not the body, or from the perspective in which you think you are the body. What is the feeling that you actually have to get? And what is getting that feeling? What is the thing that's getting that feeling? And what is the feeling composed of? Is that the correct English for Shakyamatiji? Composed of, comprised of? There's a difference. Huh? Okay. One of those tricky words. So, please think about this. Remember the Python man? He said, I'm simply lying here. I've deeply thought about all this, and I've come to the conclusion. We'll hear some more statements from the Python man, as well as from our 5-year-old hero, Prahlad Maharaj, perfect yogi at 5 years of age. Before we go deep into the situation in a tactful way, let's hear from Srimad Bhagavatam to get an overview. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om
Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
This is Srimad Bhagavatam, 3rd Canto, Chapter 7, Text 17. Yascha
Mudata Moloke.
Yascha mudata moloke. Yascha bude param gataha. Tavu bau sukam edete.
Tavu bau sukam edete.
Klishyat jan tarito
janaha. Klishyat jan tarito janaha.
Yascha Mudatamo Loke.
Yascha Mudatamo Loke.
Yascha Bude Param Gata.
Yascha Bude Param Gata.
Tavu Bao Sukham Edete.
Tavu Bao Sukham Edete.
Krishyatyantarito Janaha.
Krishyatyantarito Janaha. Yascha Mudatamo Loke.
Tama,
the lowest of the fools,
Loke,
in the world,
Yacha,
and one who is,
Bude,
of intelligence,
Param,
transcendental,
Gata,
gone,
Tao,
of them,
Ubhau,
both,
Sukham,
happiness,
Edete,
enjoy.
Krishyati,
suffer.
Antarita,
situated between.
Jana,
persons.
Translation.
Both the lowest of fools and he who is transcendental to all intelligence enjoy happiness, whereas persons between them suffer the material pangs. Purport. The lowest of fools do not understand material miseries. They pass their lives merrily and do not inquire into the miseries of life. Such persons are almost on the level of the animals who, although in the eyes of superiors are always miserable in life, are unaware of material distresses. A hog's life is degraded in its standard of happiness, which entails living in a filthy place, engaging in sex enjoyment at every opportune moment, and laboring hard in a struggle for existence. But this is unknown to the hog. Similarly, human beings who are unaware of the miseries of material existence and are happy in sex life and hard labor are the lowest of fools. Yet, because they have no sense of miseries, they supposedly enjoy so-called happiness. The other class of men, those who are liberated, and are situated in the transcendental position above intelligence, are really happy and are called paramahamsas. But persons who are neither like hogs and dogs, nor on the level of the paramahamsas, feel the material pangs. And for them, inquiry about the supreme truth is necessary. The Vedanta Sutra states, Atato Brahma Jigyasa. Now one should inquire about Brahman. This inquiry is necessary for those who are between the Paramahansas and the fools, who have forgotten the question of self-realization in the midst of a life in sense gratification. Om Jnana Timirandasya Jnananjana Shalakaya Chakshun Militam Yena Tasmai Sri Guruve Namaha. Jai Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhunitananda Sri Advaita Gadadha Sivasadi Go Bhaktavinda. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Just see this immense treasury of timeless knowledge that we're able to access, formerly locked away in the Sanskrit language, often mistranslated, yet we are so fortunate to get the inconceivable clarity of genuine Vedic knowledge from these most ancient texts. Scholars battle about the dates for the origin of various Vedic literatures. Often the battle centers upon the texts themselves, the written texts, when actually, even if there could be some agreement about the date of origin for the text, how do you date the information that has been written down? For example, if you're looking for a criminal, you may capture the footprints or the fingerprints of the criminal. That doesn't mean you've caught the criminal. So this Vedic knowledge is timeless. And just see the overview that we're getting. This is luxury in life to be able to see the whole picture and see how we fit into that whole picture. Both the lowest of fools and he who is transcendental to all intelligence enjoy happiness, whereas persons between them suffer the material pangs. Paramahansas, swan-like persons, because of their revived and active, dynamic connection with Krishna, they are relishing happiness within. That happiness within means the relationship between the part and the whole. That relationship of pure, selfless love. Because the complete whole, the Om Purnam, is unlimitedly attractive through personal qualities, through personal activities, through personal form. Therefore, the Paramahansa, the swan-like person, is far above. There's no question of such a person trying to enjoy matter. Then, the other class, the Muduttama, the Sanskrit term is, lowest of fools. Hard work, and the main reward is simply sensual indulgence. And of course, these days, that sensual indulgence is amply soaked with various forms of intoxication. Sometimes persons object upon hearing this. Oh, it's not all that. All right, but it's mostly that. Therefore, the statement is not inapplicable. It is spot on. Sometimes persons say, what do you mean hard labor? I'm not laboring hard. But hard labor doesn't simply mean a job or a business. It means existing in this world and trying to squeeze out temporary happiness, ephemeral happiness. That takes work. That's a struggle. It takes some education, some purification of the eyes to see what's going on. We get some insight into the makeup of so-called sensual happiness in the purport. Similarly, human beings who are unaware of the miseries of material existence and are happy in sex life and hard labor are the lowest of fools, yet, because they have no sense of miseries, they supposedly enjoy so-called happiness. Now just think about this. Because I don't feel that I'm suffering at the moment, therefore I'm happy. But when you look at that so-called
happiness, you find that indeed it's mostly based on forgetfulness of suffering. Let me put myself in a state in which I artificially forget my problems. And then whatever kind of so-called happiness helps me to forget, well, that's real happiness, because it helps me to forget that I'm suffering in this world. I don't know who I am. I don't know why I'm here. So even though that so-called happiness is temporary, it's enough, because I've forgotten, at least for a few moments, my suffering. And I can feel, through sensual indulgence, I can feel power and control. I exist. Instead of I think, therefore I am, it's I indulge, therefore I am. I verify my identity in that way. And of course, this is the prevailing wind that's blowing through material society. Verify your identity through sensual indulgence. Actually, that so-called pleasure through sensual indulgence is to your own, it's to the detriment of your physical well-being and your mental well-being. Every system of medicine except the Western system recognizes that sensual indulgence weakens your health and weakens your intelligence. It's there in Chinese medicine. It's there, of course, in the Ayurveda. Even in so-called indigenous people's systems of medicine, it's there to some degree. But only Western medicine seems to have evaded this issue, and in fact has presented that you're not healthy unless you're indulging. You'll have your mind will be more peaceful. Somehow or other your biological system will function better. There's an example given in the second canto of Bhagavatam. I forgot to mention that on our list of allegories we'll speak about today. I mentioned the trickling honey, the water in the desert, forest fires, mosquito bites, and chewing what has already been chewed, but I forgot to mention the camel. The camel, for those of you who don't know, can't remember the second canto of Bhagavatam, the camel enjoys by chewing on thorns. Now you immediately say, so foolish, so stupid. And what is the rasa? What is the flavor that the camel enjoys? The thorns cut the tongue of the camel, and there's a taste of blood mixed with, I guess, some kind of taste from the thorns. And the camel relishes that and never realizes he's actually tasting his own blood. He just gets attached to the flavor of thorns cutting the tongue, producing some kind of beverage, you might say, and the camel is attached to that and never thinks that the camel's weakening himself and actually destroying his health. So this is the example given in the Vedic text. For those who seek to enjoy a particular rasa or flavor of biological interaction with some emotions sprinkled in sometimes. So just think, you would laugh at the camel, you fool. But the Bhagavatam is giving that allegory so that we'll look at ourselves and we'll understand who is the real fool. And as Prabhupada writes in that purport in the second canto, nothing more needs to be said about this. So please remember these three classes of persons. The Paramahansa is the swan-like person, the lowest of fools, and in between, everyone has some anxiety and some suffering. So let's look at ourselves. We're not a Paramahansa. We're not a greatest of fools, lowest of fools. So therefore, we feel the material pangs Very appropriate word. Like hunger pangs, you know what that is like. So material pangs means you're feeling something's missing in life. I feel uncomfortable. Something's gnawing at me because I'm not getting something. It's like having the creepy crawlies in your stomach, you know? These are pangs. So those in between the paramahansas and the lowest of fools feel that way. The lowest of fools, of course, don't. They have the pangs, but they can't recognize them. And they don't think about them and don't want to think about them because they're drowning in intoxication and sensuality and the struggle to get such, which is considered hard labor. The quest for sensual indulgence is not considered hard labor these days. People just think you gotta do what you gotta do and you gotta get what you gotta get. But for those in that middle category, inquiry into the Supreme Absolute Truth is necessary, as we've heard. Because they're not dull enough and dumb enough to hide from the issues, nor are they perfected souls, so they transcend the issues, so therefore they've got some work to do. And that is the real career of the human form of life. Next text. We're going to go to Bhagavad Gita. And here we get a classification of the different types of happiness available on the material platform, in the modes of material nature. Sukham tridanim trividam. Shrinume bharatarshaba. Abhyasaramate yatra. Dukkantam cha nigacchati. Krishna is speaking. O best of the Bhartas, now please hear from me about the three kinds of happiness by which the conditioned soul enjoys and by which he sometimes comes to the end of all distress. Purport. A conditioned soul tries to enjoy material happiness again and again. Thus he chews the chewed. But sometimes in the course of such enjoyment, he becomes relieved from material entanglement by association with a great soul. In other words, a conditioned soul is always engaged in some type of sense gratification. But when he understands by good association that is only a repetition of the same thing, and he is awakened to his real Krishna consciousness, he is sometimes relieved from such repetitive so-called happiness. I just love the terminology in Srila Prabhupada's books. Repetitive so-called happiness. Remember chained victimization? Now we have repetitive so-called happiness. So something in you tells, what's wrong with trying to enjoy again and again? Nothing. Simply we need to learn what is real enjoyment. We're going to try to deal with that concept of illusory enjoyment today. But I've concluded after many, many decades of contemplation, you're dealing with a magic show. The illusory energy is a magic show. And you can't understand it by directly interacting with it. You can't understand it by being within it. You have to step out of the trap of material enjoyment, and then you can see the magic show. Krishna himself says in Bhagavad Gita, Daivyesha Gunamayi Mamaya Duraya. This material energy mind is so bewildering. You can't get your way out of it. Only, Krishna says, if you approach me and do things my way, you'll escape this massive hallucination. Because the hallucination is not just individual, it's on the social scale. Also, we have what I like to call mass consensual trance, in which everyone feeds off one another and inspires one another. Let's be an illusion. Illusion is the thing, the repetitive so-called happiness. So Krishna's going to lay the cards on the table. Please hear from me about the three kinds of happiness. And he says, sometimes the conditioned soul comes to the end of all distress, and that is by association with those who are out of the game, who are out of the cycle of repetitive so-called happiness. Next verse. Yataragre Vishamiva.
Yataragre Vishamiva.
Hariname Ritopamat.
Hariname Ritopamat.
Hariname Ritopamat. I see, I've got a mistake on my sheet. I was wondering what kind of Sanskrit it is. Parinamem ritopamam.
Parinamem ritopamam.
Tatsukam satvikam proktam.
Tatsukam satvikam proktam.
Atma buddhi prasadajam.
Atma buddhi prasadajam.
That which in the beginning may be just like poison, but at the end is just like nectar, and which awakens one to self-realization, is said to be happiness in the mode of goodness. Purport. In the pursuit of self-realization, one has to follow many rules and regulations to control the mind and the senses, and to concentrate the mind on the self. All these procedures are very difficult, bitter like poison, but if one is successful in following the regulations and comes to the transcendental position, he begins to drink real nectar and he enjoys life. Well, this purport is generally referring to the mystic yoga system, which has great austerities. It entails great austerities, very intricate process. Krishna describes it in the sixth chapter of Bhagavad Gita. You have to live in a solitary place in the Himalayas on the top of a mountain, sit in yogic asana and practice pranayama, breathing exercises, then withdrawing your senses from all sense objects. And it's a long, very difficult process. And as you know, people in this day and age don't live long enough, and they don't live in a peaceful enough atmosphere to perfect this process. But sometimes, budding practitioners of bhakti yoga in this day and age think that the rules and regulations are very difficult and bitter like poison. But really, how many rules and regulations do we have? Are they really that many? Think about it. There's just a few that may be a bit intimidating if you're still immersed in the lower taste. The four regular principles, as I like to point out, do not make you a transcendentalist. No meat eating, no gambling, no intoxication, no illicit sex. That simply makes you a human being. But because people don't know the real standard of human civilization, and you can't blame them in one sense because they're not being educated properly, not being enculturated properly, they think that these four rules are something so phenomenal, something so beyond the clouds, when actually these four rules are just ground-level living, the minimum standard to be a human being. So it is not these four rules, the regular principles, that make you transcendental. It's the Hare Krishna mantra that elevates you to the transcendental platform. The four rules simply protect you from negative influences so that you can properly ignite the fire of transcendental realization. But we have to admit, many persons make a big deal out of these four rules. Oh, bitter, so difficult. In Bhagavad Gita, as many of you know, Krishna talks about the regulative principles of freedom. Why should something that will make you free taste bitter? Only if we're in illusion, it seems that way. And the worst thing is to resent such regular principles of freedom. Resent the very lifestyle that will make you free. That makes further progress very difficult. Sometimes we see that practitioners have some problems with this huge set of rules. But at least one can admit, I know I'm an illusion. I know that what I'm doing doesn't make sense, and I hope to get myself together again. Then there's complete hope for rectification through good association. But if the person concocts, well, anyway, Doesn't matter how you behave. Krishna appreciates everyone. We're all his parts, you see. The main thing is just to believe in Krishna. That's the main thing. After all, we have imperfect senses, therefore... when we concoct like that, it makes the road back very difficult. So actually, we're not following any difficult procedures that are bitter like poison. But the few rules that we have, you know, rising early in the morning, curtailing bad habits, which will simply destroy your health, will simply destroy your mind. We may sometimes think these are bitter, but we should understand that this is due to our past conditioning. All right, let's go to the next verse. Vishayendriya samyogad yatat agre mitopamam paniname vishamiva tatsukam raja samritam tatsukam raja samsmritam. All right, we'll just read this verse and purports and let it be. That happiness which is derived from the contact of the senses with their objects, and which appears like nectar at first, but poison at the end, is said to be of the nature of passion. Purport. A young man and young woman meet, and the senses drive the young man to see her, to touch her, and to have sexual intercourse. In the beginning, this may be very pleasing to the senses, but at the end, or after some time, it becomes just like poison. They are separated, or there is divorce, there is lamentation, there is sorrow, and so forth. Such happiness is always in the mode of passion. Happiness derived from a combination of the senses and the sense objects is always a cause of distress and should be avoided by all means. So there you have Srila Prabhupada giving a graphic presentation of the otam protam, the horizontal and vertical threads making up the fabric. We'll focus on some concepts because the purport is graphic enough that everyone will get the point. In the beginning, there's this pleasing feeling to the senses. Now, there you have, in a nutshell, current Western civilization, which, of course, is now affecting the whole world. India is rapidly playing catch-up. In the beginning, very pleasing to the senses. Isn't that enough? What do you want out of life? In the beginning. Fine, finished. Why take the analysis any further? Hey, what are you Hare Krishna trying to do? You're just some kind of killjoys? You just want to deprive everyone of, the things that are normal. I mean, if you're a theist and you believe God created everything and God created us, well, didn't God give this? In the beginning, this may be very pleasing. Actually, that standard of happiness is non-human happiness in the beginning. Real human happiness, what to speak of transcendental happiness, considers the beginning, the middle, and the end. That's something we need to be trained to analyze in that way. How can it be happiness derived from a combination of the senses and the sense objects is always a cause of distress? Now, do you really accept that? Always a cause of distress. Come on, try to fight back. It's not that bad. Always a cause of distress. In order to appreciate this statement, you have to understand the accusations of Srimad Bhagavatam and Bhagavad Gita against ephemeral happiness, happiness that just comes and goes so quickly and it's so insubstantial. The word ephemeral applies also to plants. Plants with a very short life cycle. Like, you don't consider some kind of grass so seriously. The grass comes and goes. Especially around here, the sheep eat it, the cows eat it. No one's crying about the grass, unless, I guess, you're a farmer and you're very concerned with your paddocks. Still, it's not the most essential issue to you. Ephemeral happiness. If you don't know anything better, you'll be so attached to it. So in order to understand these put-downs in Bhagavad Gita and Srimad Bhagavatam, you have to understand what's better. Otherwise, you will get a little disturbed. And you will subconsciously fight back. Happiness derived from a combination of the senses and the sense objects is always a cause of distress. In order to understand that statement, we have to be able to dissect, analyze what is material happiness, particularly the happiness so prevalent these days, which is Rajaguna, in the mode of passion. Krishna has described, it appears, he didn't say it's like nectar at first. He says it appears like nectar at first. That appearance is a very important thing. Appearances, that's all you get. The appearance of happiness. The appearance of like nectar. And what is the contemporary standard? Well, look, if it appears to be like nectar, good enough. Do what you can with what you got. Even the appearance of nectar. If it appears to be like nectar, that is. That's good enough for me. Why get so hung up about analyzing these things? Well, if you're really self-interested, you will. This requires some deep thought. I've concluded it after many years of thinking about this. I can see now, finally, why the Python man said, I've thought about it a long time. And therefore, I'm just lying here. I'm not interacting with immaterial activities. I used to think about it, I must admit, as a young child. I remember, I told you before, when I was 13 or so, 14, my father, he wanted to impart some counsel to me. And he took me aside. Son, life is not a spectator sport. You've got to get into it. His version of getting into it. Well, he had his own standard. Fine wines, fine women, fast cars. So he noticed I was just too introspective and too analytical. So he was a little unsettled by that. Son, you just can't sit and watch the game. Get into it. In other words, there are things out there to enjoy. I've told you the story about the conclusion of that talk. I was 14, so he was imparting to me Divyagyan, divine knowledge. You know, you're a 14-year-old boy. There's a lot of nice young girls out there. Don't be afraid to partake of them. It's just natural. It's normal. And I responded, because I was under my mother's influence, who was a bird of a completely different feather. I said, but the Bible says that's wrong. Oh, son, you've been listening to your mother too much. You're under your mother's influence too much. My mother overheard this and she came out and said, just leave him. Just leave him, I told you, just leave him. Then she went away, and then he continued. I know your mother has these thoughts, and she's entitled to them, but the men understand what the realities are, and feel free to. It's just natural. Feel free to indulge in this way. Just be careful. We don't want anything happening that will disturb your education, of course. And then in the same conversation, he told me, by the way, I forgot to tell you, because he's about to get up and go, I forgot to tell you, you know, your sister, she's about to become a teenager. you do me a favor. If you ever see a young man walking home from school, you immediately notify me. So I did a quick mathematical calculation and figured, well, if all the young boys are encouraged to plunder and all the girls are supposed to be goody-goody, something's got to give somewhere. Yes, these topics require deep thought. And the earlier the better. Prahlad Maharaj is dealing with these subjects at 5 years old. And we're still profiting from his conclusions. All right, the next verse Krishna explains about happiness allows us to breathe easier. You know, happiness in the mode of ignorance. Yeah, we all recognize that's just nonsense. Intoxication, a drug state, drunken state. We can all agree on that. Yeah, that's... We'll go through that one quickly. Yadagre chanu bandecha.
Yadagre chanu bandecha.
Sukham bohanam atmana.
Sukham bohanam atmana.
Nidralasya pramaduktam.
Nidralasya pramaduktam.
Tatamasam udaritam.
Tatamasam udaritam.
And that happiness which is blind to self-realization, which is delusion from beginning to end, and which arises from sleep, laziness, and illusion, is said to be of the nature of ignorance. I'll just discuss briefly happiness in the mode of ignorance. From the viewpoint of happiness in the mode of passion, which is what Srila Prabhupada does in the purport, at least in the mode of passion, there's an appearance of happiness, an appearance that is going to be like nectar. But in the mode of ignorance, there's not even that appearance. That's the difference. We read in the purport, for the person in the mode of passion, there might be some kind of ephemeral happiness in the beginning. There might be. but for the person in the mode of ignorance, there's only distress, both in the beginning and end. There's not even the appearance of happiness, the semblance. All right, let's go to the story of the mirage in the desert. Next text, please. This is Prahlad Maharaj speaking. Kutra shisha shruti sukha mriga trishni rupa.
Kutra shisha shruti sukha mriga trishni rupa.
Kvedam kalevaram ashesha rujam viroha.
Kvedam kalevaram ashesha rujam viroha.
Nivijyate natu jano yalapiti vidvan. Kamanalam madulavai shamayan darapai. In this material world, every living entity desires some future happiness, which is exactly like a mirage in the desert. Where is water in the desert? Or in other words, where is happiness in this material world? As for this body, what is its value? It is merely a source of various diseases. The so-called philosophers, scientists, and politicians know this very well, but nonetheless, they aspire for temporary happiness. Happiness is very difficult to obtain, but because they are unable to control their senses, they run after the so-called happiness of the material world and never come to the right conclusion. 2 days ago, we spoke about the mental concoction of happiness. It's something the mind visualizes. And we gave example from social scientists who are starting to get some semblance of understanding about this point. And therefore, they have labeled human society as a bunch of miswanters, people who don't know how to want properly and can't even properly understand their wants. Remember the impact bias. Human beings fail at anticipating or predicting how a future event or acquisition will make them feel, whether it's happiness or distress. They overshoot the mark every time. And even the social scientists studying this phenomenon say that they themselves can't resist it. In this material world, every living entity desires some future happiness, which is exactly like a mirage in the desert. if we think about that, this example from nature, we'll get some strength. And Prahlad Maharaj wants to impart to us strength so that we can actually make our human form of life successful. We need that strength imparted from Srimad Bhagavatam, from the Bhagavatam personalities. We need that strength as imparted through Guru Parampara. We need that strength as, of course, given by the Hare Krishna mantra. Because the so-called philosophers, scientists, and politicians, they may have realized some of these points, yet they still aspire for temporary happiness. And as I said, these social scientists dealing with the science of happiness, some of them have agreed. We still aspire for these things even though we should know better. That's just the way it is. The natural example about the mirage in the desert is sufficient if you apply it in life. In the purport, we hear about the blazing fire. How can you stop a blazing fire by pouring oil or ghee on it? We all know that, right? But what about when material desires are pressing upon us? Do we consider, how am I going to make a solution to this pressure by indulging? That's like pouring oil or ghee on a fire that's already blazing. This problem can't be solved on its own level. On its own level means indulge. And then you'll get some peace. You'll get some relief. These examples from nature are a real godsend, literally, because they allow us to picture the situation in our mind's eye. As one cannot stop a blazing fire by constantly pouring ghee on it, one cannot satisfy oneself by increasing plans for sense enjoyment. We want to be happy in the material world, but this will never be possible. We shall simply increase the blazing fire of desires. So that is what you see going on in the world around you. Simply increasing the blazing fire of desires, and that's considered progress. No one has a solution how to extinguish the fire. Therefore, countless environmental, political, and social plans are foiled because they all involve, one way or another, the conclusion of pouring oil on the fire. Let's pour oil on the fire in an ecological way. Let's pour oil on the fire in a socially egalitarian way. Or let's just pour oil on the fire in a out-and-out capitalistic way. Who considers no oil on the blazing fire? The fire is already raging enough. Then again, Krishna points out, you can't just have a life of negation. Okay, there'll just be the fire there. That's it. I'll just let the fire be. I won't pour any oil on it. No, you have to do something. So the bhakti solution is cultivate spiritual desires. That causes the blazing fire of material existence to go down. We are not voidists, negativists, or negators. The bhakti process is about extinguishing the lower taste by experiencing the higher taste, the higher experience. And what is the alternative? Otherwise, in the name of happiness, we shall continue to suffer miserable conditions. In the name of happiness. Isn't that enough? In the name of happiness. At least it's an appearance. At least it's in the name of happiness. And everyone is doing like that. So remember the mirage in the desert. Where is water in the desert, Prahlad Maharaj asks. Or in other words, where is happiness in this material world? And what do we say? That's all right, Prahlad, we're going to get it. It's not that bad. We've had some magic moments. We've had some ephemeral happiness. We've had some appearances of nectar. It appears to be like nectar, in the beginning anyway. Hey, you've got to do what you can do. Get what you can get, you know. Be satisfied with, you know, what's out there. Especially since everyone is doing like that. All right, now it's time for another nature story, and this one is more extended. It speaks for itself, if I won't have to give much of a conclusion. It's about trickling honey. This is an example from Srila Vishwanatha Chakravarti Thakur. He gives it in a purport, his commentary on a verse spoken by Prahlad Maharaj. Tat sadhu manye asuya varya dehinam sadasamad vigya dhyama sagrahat hitatma patam griham andkupam. What's the last line? Louder, please. Yes. When Prahlad's father asked him what's the best thing he's learned in school, the 5-year-old boy astonished him by replying with this gem of transcendental knowledge. Tat sadhu manye asuya varya dehinam. I have considered the best thing I've learned in school is that anyone who has a material body must be in anxiety because they're identifying the body as a self, as the self. More precisely, anyone who thinks the body is the self must be in anxiety. Therefore, Father, give up this dark well of material existence. Better you go to the forest and cultivate your spiritual life. This dark well, Srila Vishwanatha Chakravarti Thakur elaborates upon it. He says, there was a man in the forest. You can just visualize the forest of material enjoyment. But, you know, in the forest, before there was such a species crisis as they have today, there are tigers. Anyway, in this allegory, there's a tiger. So the man realized a tiger is stalking him. And naturally, he tried to escape. It's very hard for a human being to outrun a tiger, especially in a forest, in the jungle. But suddenly, the man saw that there's a well, an old well, partially obscured by grass and vegetation. Ah, I'll be safe. I'll go down into this well and the tiger won't be able to see me. Or the tiger won't want to come down into this well. So how did the man get into the dark well, unused well? He saw some low-lying branches from trees around the edge of the well. Two low-lying branches. He grabbed a hold, one on each side of the branches, one hand with a branch, the other hand with a branch, and he lowered himself into the well. As he got halfway down, he saw at the bottom of the well there were numerous deadly snakes hissing and just waiting for him to reach the bottom. Obviously, the man was in quite a predicament. Which way was he going to meet his end? By the tiger above or by the snakes below? So then you might say, aha, all he has to do is just hang on the branches as long as his strength holds out and some solution will come. Just hang in there, as they say. Things will be all right. Hang in there. So there he is, you know, and the tiger's above and the snakes are below and can he just hang in there? No, because what's happening is that two rats are gnawing away at the branches. So the man knows it's just a matter of time before those rats chew those. There are two rats, one on each branch, and they're chewing the branches, gnawing away, and obviously sooner or later the man is going, you know, the branches are going to snap and down the man goes to the snakes, but he can't, while the branches are still intact, he can't raise himself up because the tiger's waiting there. Then what happens? On one of the branches, there's a honeycomb. And by the rats gnawing the branches, their gnawing is causing the branches to shake. And so the honey from the honeycomb starts trickling down the branch. and the man is able to stick his tongue out. And the honey starts trickling onto his tongue. He says, "Ah, this is nice. This is feels good." And he forgets all about his problems. Progress! Happiness! Huh? You're not convinced. Just get absorbed in the honey trickling down onto your tongue. No one seems to want to buy into that. So, I'll explain parts of this allegory. A lot of it I think you can understand. The tiger represents death, stalking us through the forest for material enjoyment. And then there's the well, the unused well. That is comparable to our seeking to make a nice situation for ourselves in this world. And then at the bottom of the well, there are the snakes. These are the various problems of material life, always just hissing. You solve one problem, and you think you have some relief, and another problem comes. Often they come five and six together. That's why intoxication is so important. You've explained. You can take your eye off the reality, forget about the snakes. And there's something even more powerful than intoxication. So those two branches are representing. One is pious activities, the other is impious activities, colloquially known as good karma, bad karma. You might think, well, if I just try to be a good person, try to maximize my good karma, minimize my bad karma, I'll still be able to somehow or other make it through life, suspend myself above the problems. But what's happening with the branches? The two rats. Each rat is gnawing on a branch. Those two rats, one is white, the other is black. One rat represents day, the other rat represents night. The passing of the days and nights. We might think, oh, I successfully went through another day yesterday. Another day has passed, another night has passed. We don't think that our life is being diminished. So those two rats, the black rat, the white rat, representing day and night, are chewing on the branches, causing the branches to shake. And above, you know, there's the tiger of death. But there's that trickle of honey from the honeycomb that has fallen upon the tongue of the man. And just that trickle of honey, feeling all right, feeling good, makes him forget about his whole situation. Forget all about the rats chewing the branches. Forget the tiger. Forget the snakes of problems below. You got to feel it. End of story. I think it's self-explanatory. Next point. Let's go to our next verse. It's Prahlad Maharaj. It's amazing what a five-year-old boy can say. Yan maitu nadi griha medi sukam hitucham. Kandu yanena karayo iva dukkha dukkam. Tripyanti neha kripana bahu dukkha bhaja. Kanduti van manasijam vishahe tadira. Translation. And don't blame me, this is a five-year-old boy speaking. I'm just reading his words. Sex life is compared to the rubbing of two hands to relieve an itch. Grihamedis, so-called grihastas, who have no spiritual knowledge, think that this itching is the greatest platform of happiness, although actually it is a source of distress. The kripanas, the fools, who are just the opposite of brahmanas, are not satisfied by repeated sensuous enjoyment. Those who are dhira, however, who are sober and who tolerate this itching, are not subjected to the sufferings of fools and rascals. In the Sanskrit, if you look at the synonyms, all right, no worries. Kanduti vat, that last line, kandutivan manasijam vishahate dira. Kandutiva, if one can learn from such itching. Now, how do you learn from the itching? By indulgence? No, you learn by hearing from Pallad Maharaj. By hearing the transcendental knowledge, the Divya Gyan, you become enlightened. You can't learn by experience. I always explain, there's nothing in the illusory energy that allows you to learn by experience. The system doesn't work that way. Remember watching Yadavara Prabhu's brilliant production of Following Srila Prabhupada? And Prabhupada was talking about New York City and why there's so many big buildings, why there's so much so-called progress. It's all Vishnu Maya. I don't think I'll ever live this one down. Vishnu Maya is Krishna's divine energy. It has two departments. Yoga Maya and Maha Maya, the covering potency and the potency that enlivens arrangements for the reciprocation between Krishna and his devotees. So much so that the devotees participating in Krishna's pastimes don't even perceive that he is the Supreme Ishvara. They just see him to be their friend, their son, their lover, so on, so forth. So, you cannot learn by experience. The magic show is too good. I don't know if you've ever seen a top-notch magician, and you'll just sit right in front of him or her, and they'll do a magical feat. And even though you're an experienced, intelligent human being, you can figure it out. Has that happened to anyone? Finally, what's the only way you can get some understanding? Ask the magician, and if he wants, he'll show you. I know one of my godbrothers, you know, Pyari Mohan, yes, Yadavara, he supports his family, which is a very dedicated outreach family. He supports his family by distributing books, but also by being a magician. So he does a magical trick, especially for young audiences and old people's homes. Instead of saying abracadabra, he says, say, Radhe Govinda. So I know about his magic shows because he took me to visit my aunt. I have a very dear aunt, and I hadn't seen her for many years, so she lives just a half hour away from the Hartford Center, where presided by Pyari Mohan and his wonderful wife. So he took me there, and he put on a magic show for my aunt and uncle. And you know, here they were, they're experienced. The uncle's in his 90s, the aunt's in her 80s. And their sensory faculties are sharp. And he just did all these magical tricks, and I just couldn't figure out how he's doing it. Until he explained. And then, oh, okay, yeah, right, yeah, oh, I could have known that. But they didn't. So basically, Krishna is telling you in Bhagavad Gita, you can't figure this out on your own. You can't figure it out by experience. The show is too good. That's tough for our ego, isn't it? The show is too good. You can only figure it out by hearing from Krishna. And we don't want to do that. Why? First of all, we're too busy, right? We have to be practical. There are things we have to do in life. No time to hear from Krishna. And secondly, well, if you hear too much from Krishna, it kind of spoils all that appearance of temporary happiness, right? The whole solution could be believe in Krishna, but don't hear too much from him. That seems to be the way forward. So Pralad Maharaj is saying, if you can learn from such itching, but he doesn't mean by experience. And he says, manasijam. This itching is simply a mental concoction. Here we go again with that transcendental point. Because actually there is no happiness. I'll tell you a story. I think I might have got it from the following Srila Prabhupada series. Since we're dealing with itching, just focus on the nature examples and remember the mirage in the desert. Now we're dealing with itching and mosquito bites. Before we discuss mosquito bites, let's consider this point in the purport, that because of a lack of education and culture, people are victimized by the false happiness of sex life. Because of a lack of education and culture. This is an indictment against society, which is doing just the opposite. So-called education and culture, all promoting sensual indulgence. There's no real human education and culture. This lack of human education and culture is why candidates to bhakti feel difficulty, because they're not coming from a proper civilization. Even in India, the system is being destroyed. The system of proper education and culture. I speak to quite a few young men and women from India in their 20s who are, they're doing the Western thing, they're living together before marriage, or who knows whether they get married. They explain it that it saves money this way. Better to pay one rent than two rents. You ask, have you discussed this with your parents? No way. Parents would have a heart attack because the parents are still traditional. So this lack of education and culture, looked at positively, we need such education and culture. We have to be eager for it. All right, mosquito bites. And Yadubarbu, you can confirm. I think I got this from, it was in Vrindavan, and Prabhupada was singing Jai Radha Madhava, and a devotee was fanning him. And the devotee kept noticing that Prabhupada would look at him and then go on chanting, and then look at him again and go on chanting. And so the devotee was wondering, what am I doing wrong? Should I stop fanning? Or, you know, because when Srila Prabhupada, as you've heard in the excerpts from this DVD series, one look from him and you feel like the deepest core of your being has just been focused upon. So this went on. And devotee didn't know what to make of it. And then Prabhupada stopped singing Jai Radha Madhava and said the Prema Dhwani, Jai Om. So then, before he started lecturing, Prabhupada began to speak to the devotee. This is from... No? Okay. It's authorized. I've heard from the devotee. And Prabhupada just turned to him. And the devotee's, oh, what's going to happen now? Because the Prabhupada gave him this look like, I know who you are, I know your situation. Prabhupada lifted up his arm. He pulled back the sleeve of his kurta. And he said, there's a mosquito bite. You scratch it, and you scratch it. Why do you stop? He's on to me. Think about it. There's a mosquito bite. And naturally, even though we know that scratching will just make it worse, who can resist scratching? You scratch, and scratch. So Prabhupada's question is, why do you stop? And he gave the answer. You stop not because there's relief, but you stop because there's blood. In other words, you made a mess. It's not that you ever felt relief. It's not that your problem was solved. It's just that, goodness, I've got a big, you know, bloody mess on my arm. I just better stop scratching it for a while anyway. Amazing example. That's not in the... Wow. I can't remember. I only watch your videos. I don't know where I got it from. Think about it. It's a nature example with a very profound point. You don't learn by scratching, and you don't get relief. You just, it becomes distasteful. You see all the problems, and then you stop temporarily, and then, of course, get back into it because you forget. Mm-hmm. Very graphic example.
Atma Tattva.
Ah, okay.
I heard it also. Yeah.
I never watch any rival editions. Amazing example, isn't it? So graphic, so deep. Why do you stop? You might think, well, you stop because you get relief and things are all right, at least for a while. No, you don't stop. The problem gets worse and the problem, or others would say, the urge, which actually isn't a problem, it's just part of life. You go on and on and on, and the only thing that makes you stop temporarily is, what a problem. All right, self-explanatory. You can think about Prahlad Maharaj's allegory, the rubbing of two hands to relieve an itch. I don't know if you ever got a mosquito bite, when I get a mosquito bite right here, and that's when you really start to... Did you like that when you get a mosquito bite right on your wrist or something? And then finally, you know, just really get into it. And then you see, you knew, but you couldn't resist. You see that, you know, it's just made it worse. The bite is just super inflamed. So that is Prahlad Maharaj's example. What is a 5-year-old boy talking like this for? Anyway, he said it, I didn't say it, so. Time for the Python Man. That's what I was looking for. I thought it was time for him again. He's much older than Prahlad Maharaj. But Prahlad Maharaj, as an adult, is touring looking for saintly persons, and he comes upon the Python Man, his touring group, just like people form tour groups and go to beaches in Thailand or something. Prahlad Maharaj's tour group is looking for saintly persons. Yes? Yeah, let's get rid of Prahlad. It's a bit too provocative. This one will be better. It'll give us some relief. I wonder if that's the right... Let me see the translation to what you have there. No, we're missing one. All right. We're looking for 7th Canto, Chapter 9. No, excuse me. 7:13:27? Really? That was it. No, it's the wrong verse, sorry. Okay, I'll just read it. Tachapi dampati nam cha sukhayan yap nup sukhayan yapanutaye kamaini kurtavan drisva nivritosmi vaparyayam. This is the Python Man speaking. You have to listen closely because you don't have it on the screen. In this human form of life, men and women unite for the sensual pleasure of sex, but by actual experience, we have observed that none of them are happy. Therefore, seeing the contrary results, I have stopped taking part in materialistic activities. He's observed. He's studied. Seeing the contrary results, I said, forget it. I'm not taking part in this. There's the hope. In this human form of life, there's that hope for unity producing pleasure. Inspired by this verse, I actually made a study. At one time I had a bus for traveling, a house bus, and I was traveling throughout New Zealand doing outreach work. And so I decided I'm going to park this small house bus in the center of Wellington, and I'm going to study people on a Friday and on a Monday. So Friday evening, I saw the faces, because it's the government capital, and everyone's pouring out of the offices, and as they pour out of the offices, the lines at the liquor shops just get longer and longer, and there's a you know, Wellington's the party capital of New Zealand, so there's like an air of excitement. Excitement's in the air, and everyone's bubbly, and oh, okay, now life can begin. It's Friday night. The cafes are starting to fill up. People are pouring into the cinemas and the clubs. So I was watching their faces, alive with that expectation of happiness. And it's that expectation of happiness that the Bhagavatam is dealing with. And now some social scientists, in their imperfect way, are trying to deal with it. They're projecting the impact bias. Oh, it's going to be a good one tonight. It's out there. We're going to get it. So I study the faces. And there's some. It's a false sense of animation and enlivenment. And unless you're skillful, you can be fooled like this. You can be fooled by this. They look happy, yeah. I mean, it's like something's going to work out. Entertainment, mirth and merriment. You'd see the ladies all decked out in their party clothes and, you know, like groups of four and five ladies, you know, heading out for who knows what. Or we don't want to know what. And the guys, they also in bunches. Laughing and joking, we're going to find something or someone tonight. And sometimes groups of both men and women. So this predator consciousness fills the atmosphere. If I had the photographic skills of the Shakyamuni or Yadavara Rumi, I would take pictures just to... In fact, I think Sukanti Radha, you did a study like this. Where are you? Are you here? Yes, you did this. I asked many years ago, I asked you to do this, right? You still have those pictures? She's a very expert photographer in capturing moods. She leaves the technical side to Thakur Saranga, but you know, she's very artistic and very expert capturing moods. She just uses a little compact camera a lot of the times and just maneuvers herself into very poignant human situations, and then yeah, we should revive those pictures. I haven't seen them in a while. So she's captured that Friday night mood. It's going to be good. We're going to feel all right. Okay, so I was studying the faces. And then, after studying Friday night, I waited till Monday morning. 8 o'clock, and watching all the people walking the streets of Wellington to their office, and I looked at the faces. Oh my goodness! It looked like a funeral. The men—I don't want to get into it too much—but the men were looking totally drained, and just like ghosts of themselves. It was totally drained, tapped, bleached, bleary-eyed. And they just, with their suits on, and their attaché cases, they're trudging along. Because Wellington's such a compact city, for those of you who don't know, you can walk to your job many times in 15 or 20 minutes. And so they're doing that, plus, you know, exercise. And their faces looked atrocious. It was just so, it was very, it really affected my heart to see these faces. The same faces Friday night, you know, they were just alive with anticipation of false illusory happiness. Now the reality kicks in, Monday. Monday morning. And then I looked at the faces of the ladies. Not too much, but it's enough to be analytical. There was nothing attractive, believe me. How did they look? I have to say, they look cross, grouchy, and just irritable. So I asked some of our lady devotees, what's that look all about? See, I couldn't figure it out, you know. I asked, well, you know, the men look drained, bleached out, bleary-eyed, and just in a daze. And the women, they look more lively in terms of physical energy, but the faces are so cross and grouchy. So the lady devotees, it's probably Guru Bani, she's the one who usually gives me these insights. Oh, I'm sorry, you're there. I didn't mean to talk about you. So, it was explained to me that they're feeling cross and grouchy because they allowed themselves to be in certain situations in order to achieve certain goals, but they're not happy, they're not satisfied, they're not fulfilled. So therefore, it's the kind of grouchiness and irritability that I did all the things I'm supposed to do, you know, I landed someone and, you know, we did all the things society tells us to do that you're supposed to do in order to be happy and get what you want, and I just... that's what those faces look like. You don't remember telling me this, do you? Yes, she does. I thought it was very lucid analysis. The men are tapped out and drained, obvious reasons. And the women are just, they don't like themselves. I did all the things that the social pressure says you should do, and I didn't get what I want. I'm not happy from it. Anyway, I'm going to work now. That's what those faces look like. So that was my application of the Python Man's observational activities. In this human form of life, men and women unite for the sensual pleasure of sex, but by actual experience we have observed that none of them are happy. Therefore, seeing the contrary results, I have stopped taking part in materialistic activities. In the purport, Prabhupada describes the Vedic system of marriage in which Dharma Virudo Bhuteshu Kamo Smi. Sex life not against the principles of religion is Krishna. And he presents that the Vedic system with its restrictions, although we may see these restrictions as problematic, from the eyes of, from the viewpoint of someone who knows, these restrictions are liberal and empowering. These restrictions give facility. But when seen from the degraded point of view, we think, oh, these restrictions really cause problems. When actually, the restrictions are such that they allow various expressions of eating, sleeping, mating, and defending in a way that doesn't harm you, and in a way that persons can make progress. You saw in the Fallen Shul Prabhupada series last night, I was remembering being there in Balboa Park in San Diego, and Prabhupada just started out giving a general lecture. It was a huge crowd of young people there. You heard Jayadwita Maharaj describe them as like gods and goddesses, bronze from the sun, and you know, long hair, and like some kind of Greek gods and goddesses. You know, Southern California. Well, you're from Southern California, right? How did you become so saintly? Oh, he said, Vishakha's Association. So the whole park was full of these types. It was the height of the countercultural period. And Southern California, the beaches, the warm air, and just everything is all right. And so Prabhupada began lecturing. Talking about the miseries of material existence to such a crowd. And then, out of a crowd of hundreds upon hundreds of young people, one young hippie stood up and interrupted Prabhupada's lecture. I don't think I made that clear enough in the memories. He stood up and started yelling at Prabhupada, "I want sex! I want sex!" Yelling enough to disrupt the whole lecture. Prabhupada could have gone on if he wanted to. It just was a disturbance, and I don't think the guy would have just kept yelling that for, you know, more than a few times. But suddenly Prabhupada stopped, literally in his tracks, his lecture, and addressed the young man's point, and started roaring back at him, "You can have it! You can have it! And here's the way!" And here I was with my fellow brahmacharis. It was Archita, it was Javita Prabhu, so many brahmacharis who are just like, oh. As Prabhupada goes into the step-by-step procedure for householders to procreate children in Krishna consciousness, the Dharma. This is the time, this is the... We're young brahmacharis, I was 25. The Prabhupada just gave it to him, right? In a crowd of hundreds of persons. He wasn't intimidated in the slightest. He stood up for the standard in such crazy circumstances. Amazing. I should have made it more emphatic in the following Srila Prabhupada series. But I guess you make so many devotees say, oh, I could have said this, I could have said that, I could have said it better. Okay. Our mouths just dropped at how fearless Prabhupada was and how he wouldn't back off of what is reality and what is illusion, even under such circumstances. I mean, to tell you the truth, I don't know how that situation would be dealt with today. Oh, it's all right. Prabhupada seized that opportunity to tell, to present, that indeed the Vedic conclusion is liberal. It embraces all activities. It's just that these activities are done in a civilized way, in a way that there can actually be progress. So in the purport of this verse, spoken by the Python Man, So Prabhupada elaborates on it. So we, somehow that we think about it, we will lose this feeling of resentment that the Vedic lifestyle is depriving us of something, when actually it's giving us human life. Next. This is Bhagavad Gita. Avritam Gyanam Etena.
Avritam Gyanam Etena.
Gyanino Nitya Vairina.
Gyanino Nitya Vairina.
Kama Rupena Konteya.
Kama Rupena Konteya.
Disparena Nalena Cha.
Disparena Nalena Cha.
Thus, the wise living entity's pure consciousness becomes covered by his eternal enemy in the form of lust, which is never satisfied and which burns like fire. Let's look at the concepts. Some concepts given in the purport. We find out something we don't like to hear sometimes, that such carnal motivations cannot be satisfied by any amount of sense enjoyment, just as fire is never extinguished by a constant supply of fuel. We also find out about Maitunya Agar, the prison house of such carnality. And the amazing thing about that prison house is there are no bars. The living entity keeps himself imprisoned by such carnal desires. Bad enough to be in a prison where there are bars. I'm sure you've not experienced. I have not experienced. But to be in a prison where the bars are not there, and you could walk out any time, any day, except for the bars that you have made in yourself. This is how expert such a prison is. We also find in this purport, and in countless purports, a radical idea when seen from the lens of current society, that sex desire is an affliction and it's a disease. We find the explanation that originally desire is pure, expressed in pure love of Krishna. But in contact with the material energy, that pure desire, that pure love, curdles like milk in contact with lemon juice. It curdles and it becomes lust. So the smart person understands, let me uncurdle the milk, literally. It can't be done with curdled milk, I don't think, can it? But it can be done with desire. You can
work to push your desire back to its original pure state. Not by silly way trying to extinguish desire, but by learning how to desire in perfection. Narottam Das Thakur, in his Prema Bhakti Chandrika, gives a very wonderful recommendation. Krishna Seva Karmarpane. You use lust perfectly by lusting to engage everything in Krishna's service. And that way the bhakti yogi is very lusty indeed. This should be for Krishna. That should be for Krishna. This person is meant for Krishna's pleasure. That's lust. Imperfection. Not that you just walk around wringing your hands and gritting your teeth until your face turns blue, but actively, dynamically lust in perfection. This is the topmost standard of yoga. The perversion that we are acquainted with has its original spiritual counterpart. The perversion is a disease, it's an affliction. This is something mundane psychologists say would have a heart attack if they heard it. So the Python Man and Prahlad Maharaj are trying to get you to see all the havoc that's caused by this quest for the appearance of happiness. Look at the damage to your body. Look at the damage to your intelligence. Look at the damage to your spiritual desire. In other words, it's bad enough we're in the bodily conception of life. Why would you want to do something that increases that? You've got an infection, and the doctor's trying to treat it, and meanwhile, you proceed to put yourself in a situation and do things that increase the infection. Doesn't make sense at all. I remember this example. It's a humorous example now because the outcome has been so wonderful. One of our couples, Grihastha couples here. The young man, he had asthma to the extent that he had to go to the hospital. And in spite of having asthma and being hospitalized, he decided to eat some ice cream. So at that point, I suggested to him, I think you need someone to take care of you. Of course, the results have been wonderful. But as an example, you know, you're hospitalized with asthma, you're taking ice cream. But, you know, you're a young devotee and, yeah, ice cream, milk products, Govinda, the cows. So the point is, we're already infected. Why do we want to do things that worsen the infection? There's no improvement. It gets worse. By hearing, the intelligent person will understand. Now, we talked about the Maitunya Agar, the prison with the invisible bars. Here's a sociological point from the purport. Advancement of material civilization on the basis of sense gratification means increasing the duration of the material existence of a living entity. Increasing your jail term. What we think is pleasure is lengthening our time in prison. I concluded the only way we can really deal with these points is by just hearing. Because the magic show is too good. It's just too overpowering. And our pride is so great. I can figure it out. I've experienced. And what does Shukadeva Goswami say in the beginning of Second Canto? Pashyana pina pashyati. You're sufficiently experienced, but still you do not see. Very profound point. You'll never see by experience. You can only see by hearing from an authorized source. One last point from this purport. The so-called feeling of happiness is the ultimate enemy of the sense enjoyer. Well, let's start at the beginning of that sentence. While one enjoys sense gratification, it may be that there is some feeling of happiness. See, there's some concession here. There's some liberality.
It may be that there is some feeling of happiness while one enjoys sense gratification. But actually that so-called feeling of happiness is the ultimate enemy of the sense enjoyer. This is too much. Come on. I mean, really. You know, we love Krishna, we love Prabhupada, but really sometimes this just gets a bit over the top with him. Really? I mean, oh, come on. Do you really expect this Krishna consciousness to become popular throughout the world with statements like that? Actually, the so-called feeling of happiness is the ultimate enemy of the sense enjoyer. Why? Because that so-called feeling of happiness is not actually happiness, yet you become attached to it. So you're thinking, I'm feeling good, I got the feeling. And just that phenomenon alone worsens your situation. And you become attached to that phenomenon of illusion. It requires a lot of thought at this point. Because we're so desperate, we're so starved for happiness that even the appearance of even something that appears to be happiness, the semblance of happiness, fleeting happiness, whatever you want to call it, give it to me. It's better than nothing. I was thinking of another example. I don't know if I'll say it or not. But yeah. How can it be the worst enemy? Because you go deeper into illusion. You have your false expectations they increase. Your attachment to the body increases. Your mind becomes more afflicted by material desires. You literally become chewed up by material existence and spit out, but you don't give it up. Even sometimes you may lament, oh, I'll never do that again, and you get right back into it because of the hypnotic effect of illusory energy. So this is why the purport says it's the greatest enemy. Even those semblance feelings of happiness are actually the worst thing for you. Why not take real happiness? Become qualified for real happiness. We'll go to the last verse. The Bhagavatam verse, first canto. Yes. Srinvatam Swakata Krishna.
Srinvatam Swakata.
Punya Shravana Kirtana
Priyantasto
Yabhadrani Vidunoti
Sirhitsatam.
Translation: Sri Krishna, the Personality of Godhead, who is the Paramatma, Super Soul in everyone's heart, and the benefactor of the truthful devotee, cleanses desire for material enjoyment from the heart of the devotee who has developed the urge to hear his messages, which are in themselves virtuous when properly heard and chanted. Krishna is on your side. When you hear about him from within your heart as a super soul, he starts cleaning. He's not lazy in your heart, as Prabhupada said once. He's working on your behalf. He's doing his part. He's more eager for you to go back to him than you are. So how do you get this urge to hear about Krishna? That's stated earlier. Mahatsevam, no. Vasudeva Kata Ruchi Sian Mahat Sevaya Vipra. By rendering selfless service to the Lord's devotee, you develop the taste, the ruchi, for hearing about Krishna. That urge comes by selfless service. And then with that urge, you indulge in hearing about Krishna, and Krishna from within your heart starts cleaning. Get rid of those illusory desires. Krishna makes you immune to the magic show. So please remember these examples from nature. The trickling honey, the mirage in the desert, water in the desert, forest fires, mosquito bites, chewing what's already been chewed. Any questions? Yes.
Thinking about how we don't learn, we don't learn from experience. So why do we need the brahmacharya? Are these experiences? If we're not getting anything, why go through all of that? The question's not completely clear.
Yeah, I think you've got two things packed together here.
Right.
Why does someone lead the brahmacharya ashram to become a grihastha? They want to experience family life in a way that they'll become purified, not putrefied. Hopefully. Everyone will agree. We come into this world alone and we leave alone, so it's better to keep the situation as simple as possible. No one will object to that statement. But that medicine of the brahmacharya ashram as a continuous situation is not the best medicine for everyone. So this is the liberality of the Vedic system. Psychophysical natures need different types of medicine. So it's there. In other words, your question is about the magnanimity and liberality of Vedic culture, Vedic civilization, rather than seeing it as an impediment and as something, you know, to be resented. It's actually magnanimous. Okay, here's a way that you can act and be purified. Now, I was astonished once to hear Srila Prabhupada say, when he was quoting Dharma Viruddha Bhuteshu, Kamosmi, Krishna saying, I am procreative activity done according to Dharma. I've heard Prabhupada say, you can experience Krishna in this way. You can see Krishna in this way. Now, it's not, I don't know anything about that, but I heard him say that. He said, otherwise, why does Krishna say it? He says, Rasaham Apsakonteya, I'm the taste of water. So similarly, Dharma Viruddha Bhuteshu, I am that comma, according to Dharma. You can see Krishna in this way. It's not my ashram, but I can't, you know. I was shocked at Prabhupada just bringing out the dynamics of Bhagavad Gita in such a comprehensive way. He didn't flinch. Your second part of your question? Question's not well formulated. Can get the one who answers the questions in trouble.
Yeah, sorry. Act and be purified. Is that act and be purified? Is that experience that we learn from?
It's authorized experience.
Right. So
Prahlad Maharaj was not talking about grihasthas. And Prabhupada makes that clear in his amplification of the verse. Grihamedis. So-called grihasthas. Real grihasthas are very worshipable. So, as you heard in the purports, and you have persons here who can tell you their experiences. Of course, I have observed, having traveled on every continent. I also have a family, you know, mother, father, brothers, sisters, aunts and uncles and all that. Sometimes devotees forget that sannyasis, they come from families. You know? My mother just sent me an email message. I was telling Yadavar, your brother has been invited by the President of the USA for a Christmas party at the White House. So, you know, I know what it's like to have a family and social pressure. I know it's behind it all. She's saying, you could have been even greater than that. Your brother's in the White House. Our family has achieved the supreme destination. Your brother has been invited to the president's Christmas party. I told you about the time a few years ago she contacted me and told me something she never told me before. I never told you this, but when your grandmother died 10 years ago, she left a special fund for you. She left money for you, earmarked for when you come home. Think about it.
Damn.
She thought it was like, ooh, now I've got him. An inheritance earmarked for when he gives up that devotional lifestyle and comes home.
Did you ask her how much?
No, I obviously it was substantial, so therefore she could, you know, she felt confident in making the presentation. And she's very clever, so she, you know, waited a while and she said, "It's there for you when you come home." Another pause. "Think about it." So I just responded. I said, "Hey, come, mother, I'm, you know." At that time, I was like 55. I said, "I'm 55. I'm almost dead." "Oh, don't say that." Because at that time, she was like 78, so I was giving her a hint. You know? I said, "What am I going to do with the money? Just get a house with it and watch TV all day?" And then she gave her what she thought was a real closer, you know, the clincher. Said, "You know, at my church, there's lots of ladies, and they know about you. They're part of my prayer group. And every week, they get down on their knees praying to the Lord to make you theirs." I said, "Well, mother, tell them to stay on their knees. Keep praying. It's good for them, but it's not happening." "Don't stay on their knees. Very happy. They're praying. We are non-sectarian. We encourage all processes of prayer. We don't want to disturb them and discourage them from praying. Like, yeah, let them go on." So, anyway, that ended the phone conversation. So, my point was to show, you know, sannyasis also, we have families, we have, you know, we have family pressures to deal with, and so, it's not that you have to learn everything by having a family of your own, but nevertheless, it is true, as Vishakha Mataji was explaining yesterday, in terms of having children in Krishna consciousness and raising them, you never know what it's like by observing or hearing from others. It's something to be experienced, and wow, you realize your life is no longer your own. You're another living entity is dependent on you 24 hours a day. And we remember, I've also heard this point raised, family life without children is marriage without children is zero. So it was very enlightening, Prabhupada's take on that. Of course, you know, Prabhupada is talking to different persons and knows what's good for particular persons in particular situations. So when Yadubar asked him, "Yesterday I heard you say that marriage without children is like zero." And Prabhupada said, that's for ordinary persons. Of course, Vishakha Mataji clarified Jamuna, the one who Prabhupada said that to, wasn't an ordinary person, but Prabhupada was just making use of ordinary axioms to encourage them in their situation because they were husbandless. So, and then he told Yadubarbhu and Vishakama, at least Yadubarbhu, he told, "Make Krishna your child." So, these issues have to be approached maturely. Another point that even I, from my standpoint, have heard a bit too often, and I was discussing this with Yadubarbhu and Vishakha Mataji yesterday, a concept I've heard from a particular segment of our devotee community, the concept of the biological clock ticking. And because the biological clock is ticking, I don't think it's the male biological clock being referred to. Because the biological clock is ticking, you've got to wrap up a deal really quick. And as soon as you wrap up the deal, you've got to, you got to bring that babe into the world because time is running out. You've got to close the deal really quick. Because after all, tick-tock, tick-tock, the biological clock is ticking. That becomes the driver of the situation. It's like in a sports game.
It's an easy American football example, but none of you know about American football. So, and to make it generic, you realize there's 1 minute left in the match. We've got to score. We'll try anything because we've got to score. That becomes the overriding reality. Yes, in ladies' sports too. What was it, netball they play in New Zealand, or what, soccer or something? Netball, yes. So, when the clock is winding down and the game is about to end, you've got to do something if you're behind. And so the predominant reality is the clock. Similarly, there's a theory that I've heard going around that, after all, look at my biological clock. I've got to tie someone down, and as soon as I tie him down, the babe's got to come, because after all, the biological clock is ticking. So, Vishakha Mataji, she's a lady of brevity and eloquence. Essential truth spoken concisely. She just said, that is very dangerous. Very dangerous. And based on my travels around the world, I have to agree. I've just seen big mistakes done putting this biological clock theory into action. Making that the driver, not the only driver, but a major driver of the situation. I've seen a lot of lamentation, a lot of disruption, a lot of agony. It's a mode of passion decision-making process. It's not making a decision in the mode of goodness, what to speak of transcendental. All right, enough said about that. Back to your question again. Of a Vishakha Mataji you wanted to? No? Okay, yes?
Well, actually,
all right. Well, all right, I'll say it. I mean, you get a wife like Karuna Karuna Mataji, life isn't so bad. She's not here, so she didn't hear that. That's good. Yes, I mean, I guess you had good spiritual taste and you're reaping the results. Similarly, Yadavar Prabhu, he had good taste, although they didn't, when Vishakha Mataji was telling the story how they met, she didn't tell who actioned the situation. I just remember you saw him through a clear pane of window or something, a window to the spiritual world, and you saw him and heard a voice saying, that's him. But we didn't hear, how he was acquisitioned, or vice versa. Who said the first, who? No, but I have to add some little, lightness to the subject matter today. I mean, who introduced who first? She came up to you and helped me hang a picture. Generally the men, they don't remember these things. The ladies always remember. I've had that experience. They remember every word. It's like Dharma Satyapur, who tells a story of how he actually didn't seem to remember so clearly, but Karuna Karuna remembered exactly. They were Sankirtan devotees at Soho in London, and there was a book closet where you go to get your books, and fulfilling the desires of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. Anyway, as a result, we have a very wonderful householder couple that very dear to all the devotees. They're mentoring so many devotees, showing them the genuine standard of household life. Whenever I see the Guru Maharaj, His Holiness Shivaram Maharaj, I always thank him for such wonderful disciples. Yet and still, there are strange creatures in Saffron who can't see their way to complexities, shall we say. So they're an endangered species these days. and they're taking literally that you come into this world with nothing and you leave with nothing, so why not keep it as simple as possible? If they can honestly do that, there's different medicine for different individuals. All the medicines are honorable. This is the point. The Prahlad Maharaj is not talking about Grihasthas. He's talking about Grihamedis. Those who believe or espouse or act upon unrestricted gratification of the senses. And will even try to defend that position. So, as you all may know, our policy is to see that everyone takes the appropriate medicine. Honestly. Yes, the saffron ashrams get some kind of respectability because the ultimate goal of all the ashrams is to reduce and then do away with the temporary association between male and female. But they go about that goal in different ways. Therefore, they're all honorable ways of approaching the same goal. It's like Srila Prabhupada would always explain. All the ashramas, the four ashramas, Brahmachari, Grihastha, Vanaprastha, Sannyas, they're all in relation to a certain activity. They're all in relation to a certain biological activity. And they approach that activity from different points of view, different angles of behavior. In three ashrams, it's non-existent. In one ashram, it's limited. But still, all the ashrams are material arrangements given by Krishna, but they're material arrangements in relation to a certain activity. So if you understand that, you can see the medical treatment in action. And then one takes up the appropriate medical treatment. It's a fact, though, at least when you die, whatever your situation is, you're going to have to leave it behind. So therefore, the saffron ashrams get a little respect because they're acting on that conclusion that they're going to have to face at the time of death. Then again, though, we want, and sometimes we've had big wars about this between myself and the Brahmachari Ashram, we want respect for Grihasthas, and we don't tolerate anything else. We don't want any of that crass talk. We don't want any categorical put-downs. Things that myself and my peers might have said in the 70s, we don't want to see a trace of that. Shaka Manji was telling me one statement, you know, close to 40 years ago. Traveling party of brahmacharis were cautioned, don't approach any women on Sankirtan because maybe your conscience can't handle it. I can understand that. But because if they become devotees, then they'll want to marry and they'll decrease the brahmachari population. So better you don't approach them so that there's not so many, don't approach the ladies on book disagreements so there's not so many potential lady devotees. And then the brahmacharis will automatically say brahmacharis, how do you know? It's all so simple, isn't it? It sounds ridiculous now, but, you know, we were young, and taking things Prabhupada said way out of context. We didn't have any life experience. Prabhupada took our enthusiasm and engaged it in amazing selfless sacrifice, amazing risks. So, as the brahmacharis know, after several wars conducted by the Swami, we hope we have purged all that out. Is it so? The householders should think the brahmacharis are respectable, especially if they're genuine brahmacharis, studying the shastra, living simply, selfless service. And the brahmacharis should think that the grihasthas are very exemplary, being able to live a Krishna Krishna-centered family life. It's simply the brahmachari. If he plans to be a brahmachari of long duration, he's thinking, it's not the medicine for me. I can't handle it. There's nothing wrong with not being able to handle family life. Doesn't mean you're a lower species because you can't handle it. There are financial situations involved. Unless you get one of our celebrated low-maintenance Matajis that does decrease the problem. And we've heard how Krishna does mystically provide for his dedicated householder devotees. But some brahmacharis, you know, they have rightfully considered, like the Python man, lying here, I have considered, and I just don't see the need to... So everything is needed, especially for newcomers to Krishna consciousness. They like seeing the variegatedness of lifestyle. There are the monks. There are the ladies. There are the married couples. And we have to give the ladies credit. They're doing wonderful preaching, and so many of the men devotees, so many of the brahmacharis are devotees because they met a Vaikuntha angel who encouraged them to chant Hare Krishna. And such combination of female charm saturated with the desire to please Lord Chaitanya, it was irresistible. So we try to encourage everyone, be realistic about everyone's strengths and weaknesses, and we stay away from fanaticism. The ideal is, as Prabhupada once said, every man should remain a brahmachari and every woman should marry. You remember that? Obviously something's got to give. So I'm very happy with many of our householders who are so dedicated and selfless and really trying to be genuine. I know it's not easy all the time. I know that. I may not say it to you. Dad can see these things. And similarly, it's not easy for the brahmacharis all the time. Every ashram has its austerities. You ever thought you wanted to travel, huh? Would it be nice to travel all over the world? I always say, just like most people dream of traveling, I dream of no traveling. Wouldn't it be nice to stay in one place and just not have to live out of a suitcase? I remember I stayed with Salana Shivaram Raj in Hungary for, I think, 3 months or so. And so I stayed at his house, and so, you know, came in with my suitcases, and as out of a habit, you know, I just put my suitcases on the floor and was getting my things from the suitcase. So I remember he came in and told me, I think you're going to be here for 3 months. You can unpack your suitcases. That was such a weird feeling, to unpack a suitcase and put things in a drawer. And so I did it, his servant, Sean Bihari, came and took the suitcases and put them in a storage area in the house. I went to sleep that night, and I woke up in the middle of the night, where are my suitcases? Where are my suitcases? I felt weird. They weren't in the same room with me. So every ashram has its austerities. Householder devotees, they always tell me, we don't know how you do it. Of course, I don't know how I do it either. But guess what? The sannyasis and brahmacharis from their side are thinking, we don't know how you all do it. So everyone has mutual respect. I don't know how you do it. That's the ideal situation. Everyone has respect. Ladies have a question. Yes. It's from Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur's commentary, as I said, on a particular verse in Bhagavatam. You like the story? Yes. Benjamin, you really come up with these interesting angles. That's good, you're thinking. Materially, there's never a cessation. It goes on and on and on. It's a never-ending movie. You're on a treadmill. You have to get off. Reminds you of, maybe you remember this, Yadavarkabu. I was on a walk in Mumbai, I believe, and a devotee was saying to Prabhupada, so the Vedic system is that when you reach 50, you know, punch a sword from Vanam Vrajet, you know, the classic Vedic statement, when you reach 50, you prepare to go to the forest. So the devotee was asking Prabhupada, so is it that when you reach 50, all the complexities and entanglements just kind of slide away and then you walk into the forest? Is that why the Vedas say 50? Because at that time, you know, just the waters of complexity recede. That was Prabhupada's answer. It'll never end. It's just at the age of 50 you say, that's it. The complexities just go on and on and on. They'll never end. But it's just at a certain point you draw the line. So yes, we have to decide, as Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, yesham to antakatam papam. There's a time to make a complete stop, especially to sinful activity. There's a time to draw the line and say, that's it. So don't wait for the waters of Maya to recede. They'll never recede. You can't make a solution in that way. Through transcendental Krishna consciousness, you've got to get out of the water. Get off the field. So the various ashrams are different ways that you take your medicine. But you have to take your medicine. This is transcendental environmental science. The environment is such a way. It acts in that way. You just got to get out. There's no question of just, you know, putting smokestack filters in or cleaning up the rivers. You got to get out. So next time we'll talk about how you get out. More specifically, what's there when you get out. We'll talk about the nectar of selfless service to Krishna. All right, we're way over time. I apologize for those who we've inconvenienced. I think it was an important topic. I hope we dealt with it in such a way that there are no skunk odors. Please think about it. You can save yourself so much trouble. Thank you very much. Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna. Jai.
Please, 1 second. Bhadrasain has a very quick announcement.
Hare Krishna. Thank you for waiting just one more minute. In regard, for some of you may not have, most in New Zealand have David Ridaswami's new book, Bhakti.